Okay, you're listening to Biotech Hangout, a live and unedited weekly discussion of all the latest news in our industry with a group of biotech insiders. I'm Brad Loncar, and my co-hosts today are Daphne Zohar, Tim Oppler, hopefully, Brian Squirny, Luba Greenwood, and Yaron Werber. For more information about our hosts and guest speakers, or to listen to the most recent episode, please go to biotechhangout.com. So as I said, we have a ton to talk about today. We'll get right into this. And I'm going to start with this morning's news because there were two major things in the news this morning. I'm going to start with you, Brian. So you're kind of our resident Alzheimer's expert. I know you followed all of these programs and, you know, especially Biogen really closely. So this morning it was announced that Eli Lilly's program, donanemab, is going to have an AdCom. And so I'll just kick it over to you. Tell us, like, how surprising or unsurprising is this? And what does it mean, not just for Lilly, but potentially for, you know, Biogen, which has a product on the market right now, and other competitors?
Yeah, so, you know, how surprising is that? So I guess I will say I've been kind of bashing on this drug for a while here. So even so, I'm very surprised because it comes so proximally to a PDUFA date. I mean, they've not announced the specific PDUFA date, just that it was first quarter here. And so obviously, I mean, they could have had the PDUFA date today or tomorrow or sometime in the next 3 weeks. But for the FDA to basically punt the PDUFA date, you know, not indefinitely, but to sometime after an AdCom and decide to call an AdCom is certainly perplexing. I don't think it is in light of some of the issues that I have with the data. But this is interesting. It's actually the third regulatory setback that this drug has had. Lilly submitted for an accelerated approval back in 2022 based on but the plaque reductions that they saw in their phase two. As you recall, aducanumab got accelerated approval on plaque reductions. Lecanemab got approval initially on subpart H for plaque reductions. And the FDA gave Lilly a complete response letter on the subpart H application. So that was sort of the first rejection. They characterized that they needed more long-term safety data. The company submitted pretty quickly for full approval a couple of months later when they got their phase three Trailblazer 2 data set for donanemab, and they did receive priority review and originally had a PDUFA in fourth quarter 2023, but that was delayed on Lilly's third quarter call. They said that it was delayed until first quarter this year, and now the FDA is delaying even further. So look, the reason that Lilly outlined for the AdCom in their PR this morning was the FDA wants to understand topics related to evaluating safety and efficacy, including the safety results in donanemab-treated patients, and the efficacy implications of the new trial design, including its limited duration dosing regimen that allows patients to complete treatment based on assessment of amyloid plaque, and the inclusion of participants based on tau level. So look, there's three things here. I think my main safety concern, and I think we'll hear a little bit from the FDA on, is the safety profile. And I think it looks way worse than Leqembi, basically double the ARIA rates across the board. There were also three patient deaths that I think in the manuscript look pretty attributable to donanemab. The events for Leqembi were really litigated in the FDA review, included a lot of open label data from the extension. And we think there's really only one that may even be attributable to lecanemab over a much longer follow-up period and more patients. But I think that safety differential is pretty clear between the two. I would argue there's no distinguishable difference between the two on efficacy, but there are some nuances that could be argued in favor of each. Trailblazer 2, the donanemab study, screened based on tau levels, and the results were inconsistent kind of depending on how the tau data is cut. Therefore, we think they probably run the risk of donanemab requiring baseline tau measurements. Leqembi didn't screen for tau as a baseline requirement and has a broad label that doesn't consider tau as a criteria for treatment. So if donanemab requires measurement of tau, this is another PET scan on top of the amyloid plaque PET scan that patients already have to get for Leqembi or aducanumab. And we think that additional PET scan, that's going to be a differentiator for anyone who doesn't require that. And then the third thing is in Trailblazer 2, patients who met a plaque clearance on treatment criteria were able to stop all therapy. And this abbreviated treatment regimen has really been one of the arguments in favor of donanemab. You know, why take something lifelong like Leqembi if you could get the same results from just a few months of treatment? And look, that whole hypothesis just sounds crazy to me. I mean, these are both passive immunizations with monoclonal antibodies. To think that this is permanently altered pathophysiology really is not scientifically grounded. I think there's going to be questions on how do you plan on monitoring for rebound? Do patients have to get regular amyloid PETs? Can you do blood-based measurements to screen for it? And do you even know that the disease wouldn't start getting worse before you could see plaque again? It just seems very scientifically uninformed for me. So, for Lilly, everyone's chasing tirzepatide and obesity. So it's, only a little flesh wound this morning. I think it's good for Eisai and Biogen, though.
It's amazing to think of it in that context. I mean, 4 or 5 years ago, for like a decade, we always talked about Lilly as like the Alzheimer's company, the leader working on this. And now it really, because of their obesity franchise, it does, cushion them so much. Do any of the other panelists have comments on this? No? Okay. We're going to go next. I'm going to kick it over to Luba about this morning's other big news. And unfortunately, this is some sad news for patients. So one of the biggest data releases we've been anticipating in the first half of the year is Amylyx's phase 3 Phoenix data in ALS. And Luba, why don't you just go into what they announced and what it means.
Sure. Thanks, Brad. So absolutely sad news. I would have to say, and unfortunately, although I think probably many of the, including the listeners in the space, probably agree that for some, this was not unexpected. Just as a, to give an overview, we just heard that their Amylyx ALS drug that was in the phase 3 study just failed. They did enroll about 664 patients, and they failed to slow progression of ALS. These results are pretty stunning, since they showed absolutely no difference between patients that received the drug that were on the and those that were on the placebo, and they also entirely failed to meet primary and secondary endpoints. They did announce that they may pull it from the market. That's probably the right thing to do. And they're certainly stopping the promotion of the drug right now. They will publish results later this year, so it would be good to really dig into it. Although from this announcement, I think that we may have a sense of what happened there. Their stock dropped as a result over 80% already today. After their announcement, remember their stock went up significantly in 2020 and 2022. That was after the FDA did approve this drug mid-trial, and only after really a single study. That was a highly controversial decision. It was around September of 22. People were anticipating and waiting to see what happens. And when it was approved, it was $158,000 per year per treatment that ultimately had no efficacy. So I'd be curious to see. I would anticipate that they may pull this from the market. But interesting, I would love to hear from other panelists what they're thinking about now looking back about that controversial decision by the FDA in 2022 and how it resulted in where we are today.
I'd be happy to just comment on, we talked a lot about accelerated approval last week, and I think that, first of all, it's very sad for patients, but it's even more sad for patients if there's a drug that doesn't work that is on the market. And so I think what this shows is, first of all, kudos to Amylyx for running the study, doing it quickly. And they had previously committed that they would pull it if it didn't work. Yep. So I think that that's probably going to happen. And what that means is that the system is working well. And I actually think it's a good thing for accelerated approvals. Obviously, very sad for patients.
I would just jump in and say, I think one of the interesting dynamics here is, this is not actually an accelerated approval. This was a full approval on a clinical efficacy study. So one of the very interesting nuances here, my colleague Joel covers Amylyx here, but I can give you some of the sentiment from investors on this name. People were very skeptical that this would hit in a classical fashion where you would hit on a primary endpoint of a p-value below 0.05 and have concordant secondary endpoints. But the view is kind of, there's not really a clear FDA way for them to pull this drug without some sort of safety signal, right? In subpart H, and we've seen how hard it is to remove drugs even under accelerated approval on failed studies. You know, I think the sentiment was, well, if there's a subgroup or if like it's a p-value of 0.07 or you have, you know, a secondary endpoint that's nominally significant, they could keep this drug on the market and the FDA doesn't really have much recourse here.
But Brian,
I think if anything surprising is just how bad this data, you know, a point p-value of 0.6 is, you know, kind of shocking.
Brian, but didn't they agree? I remember when the first announcement came out that they agreed that they would pull it. Did they only
they
say
did.
That was subject to tox signals, or did they say that they would pull it for lack of efficacy?
So the CEO said at the panel that they'd do the right thing by patients, right? That's the quote, and people have been debating around that quote, what that really means. To be fair to Justin and Josh, I mean, based on some of the reports today, I mean, it sounds like they are seriously considering that as the best option for patients because the data just really didn't seem to show any separation or indication of an effect here. I'm just saying broadly, they don't have to. And the FDA doesn't really, in my understanding, have a clear way to force it off the market.
Yet.
Because there was no post-approval requirement to maintain approval. So it's just an interesting dynamic relative to what we've seen on the back and forth on subpart H's, because this is not the same type of approval.
Yeah, and I agree. And I think that was the controversy as well initially when they did approve it sort of midway through like this. I think that there were some worries about that this would happen potentially. And what are the implications? Are they going to have to actually pull it or not, legally speaking?
And I'll just say, I know this is obviously a difficult day for Justin and Josh. You know, they've been on this program before, and I've interviewed them a couple of times for Biotech TV. And I've always been impressed with their professionalism. You know, in these types of spaces, sometimes you have companies that are very hypey. And even through the approval, they were never like that. You know, this was something that the patient community really argued for strongly. And I've always gotten the sense that, you know, they've always tried to do the best thing for patients. And they've never really, you know, they've always been very professional and like developed this the right way. So really sorry to see this, you know, happen for patients and see it happen to them. But I'm sure that they'll do the right thing with this. But sad news for biotech. We always want these trials to succeed. And also these, you know, this is one of these catalysts that I kind of feel like could affect like biotech sentiment period because it's so high profile. So it's really unfortunate to see this outcome. Let's move over to your own. So your own, I'm sure you're going to sleep well this weekend. Hopefully you have some R&R planned. So you just had your TD Cowen conference all last week in Boston. So I'd like to ask you about just kind of like how it went, like what's the general sense of investors right now? Maybe we'll start with like some of the key themes in biotech. So like obviously everyone's talking about obesity, and I know you had some panels and looked really closely at, you know, Lilly and Novo and even like some of the larger companies that aren't quite commercial yet, like Amgen. What were some of the takeaways?
Yeah, thanks, Brett. So I'm going to sleep like 25 hours a day, I think, for the next 2 days. This one was, first of all, it was great to see that we didn't get any snow. There was no blizzard. So which half the time we feel like everybody gets delayed because of some kind of blizzard in Boston. Attendance was literally a record high for a 44th conference. I think it's critical to see it. It felt like JPM was a little light, not talking about JPM itself. It just talks about like San Francisco felt light in January. And so people were a little worried. I can tell you that the attendance was insanely huge and everything was packed. And sentiment feels a lot better. We definitely saw a fair amount of generalists. Some of it was probably because of an AI angle. We did run a whole bunch of stuff on AI. But there were definitely generalists there. The obesity panel was fairly packed. And then the question is, what does this mean for the sector performance for the rest of the year? So we put out sort of two interesting pieces, I think interesting each year. One is after JPM and how does the sector performance into and out of JPM bode for the year? We were up in the beginning of the year. If you look at history, it suggested we had a 78% chance of being up for the year, but probably not going to outperform the market. Heading into Cowen and into our conference, there was a good chance we were up. And then we were up incrementally. And so at that point this week, and literally what's going to happen, I would say in the next 3.5 hours, is going to be pretty important if you kind of look at historical data. It's sort of almost like an even Steven right now. We're sort of flattish now. Heading into the conference, we're a little positive. Would then suggest there's like an 83% chance of being positive for the year. But if we finish this conference negative, it suggests it's got more of a negative bent. If we're kind of like neutral, we're like sort of neutralish now, like 57% chance we're going to be sort of up and 43% chance we're going to be down. So I'm definitely watching the next, 3 hours, so to speak. So let's talk on diabetes. And there was a lot on Amgen, and there was actually a really interesting panel in the elections too we can talk about. So on the obesity panel, Lilly looks like the runaway winner in terms of tirzepatide. Again, this is looking at efficacy. There's a big question, ultimately, what's going to happen with SEMA eventually goes off patent, and obviously what's going to happen to pricing, what's going to happen to reimbursement and access, and obviously manufacturing. But in obesity, it really looks really good. Novo, though, with CagriSema looks really, really good for diabetics. That data is like a 15% weight loss at 32 weeks, a negative 2% A1C. I mean, that data, that's a GLP-1 / amylin combo, fixed dose. That looks really good. That looks like the combo to beat in diabetes while they're still generating the data in obesity. I think the consultants are a little less bullish on obesity relative to tirzepatide, but they really like the mechanism for diabetics. And then yesterday, and I know you're going to ask about that, Brad, Novo had their capital markets day, and they released their data for their oral peptide, amycretin, which is a dual-acting GLP-1 / amylin agonist, and this is in obesity. They showed a 13% weight loss at 12 weeks as an oral. Now, what they didn't say anything at all on is safety, and safety is always critical with the orals. They're saying that the AEs were as expected. It's obviously a peptide. So they're also testing it with a subcutaneous version in phase 1. We'll have the data next year. One would imagine a sub-Q injection with a peptide is going to yield even a better weight loss. But obviously the oral angle is interesting. The fact that they didn't release any safety, I think, is drawing some kind of people to raise their eyebrows a little bit. And then finally, an AMG 133 or MariTide, which has always been getting huge attention and accolades from clinicians. Well, now that the Nature Medicine paper came out a month ago, and that showed the 4 out of 8 patients at that relevant 420 milligram monthly high dose dropped out, clinicians are a lot more worrying. They do admit that Amgen didn't do any titration. And so you ask them, so, hey, what would happen if you just took a patient and put them on 2.4 mg, like the high dose of SEMA or tirzepatide? And then both of them kind of chuckled and they said, well, those patients are going to be admitted and they'll never talk to them ever again. So they definitely said that let's see what Amgen does once they sort of dose titrate. But there's obviously a lot more questions now about GIPR antagonism. That's the novel sort of second mechanism from Amgen.
And you mentioned the election. So President Biden had a State of the Union address last night. And like with the Inflation Reduction Act, the risk has always been like, you give a politician an inch and there's like the slippery slope and they eventually take a mile one day. And he was in the news saying that he wants to increase the number of negotiated drugs from like 20 to 50. And, maybe one day, like it'll be like every drug. Yeah. Like what are investors saying about like the risks of the political talk, just like, totally going off the rails between now and election day?
Yeah, so, the bigger conversation, we'll talk about the actual what's going to happen in this election, because this election is going to be, super important to watch. But, we're at a point that Democrats and Republicans both are not fans of pharma and biotech. This seems like a lot of posturing from Biden. You know, Trump has not been a huge fan or a huge, you know, friend to biotech and pharma either. So there's going to be some, you know, snipping back and forth. But at the same time, behind closed doors, they are trying to get a few things done across the aisles and fixing a few things on the 13 versus the 9 and some of the orphan drug legislation or provisions. At the end, we're very skeptical this is going to go through, just given what's going to happen with the election. So maybe just to touch on that, I mean, it looks like Trump's going to be the nominee. This is going to be, again, very close, right? You look at 2020, as we all know, 43,000 votes in Arizona, Georgia, and Wisconsin. You look at 22, when the House flipped, it was 12,000 votes in Arizona, California, Colorado, New York, flipped the House. This, all you need to do, if you live in Pennsylvania and you don't like politics, you might want to move out now because you're going to get absolutely bombarded with lobbying and ads. The way Pennsylvania goes, the way goes the nation, it's really going to come down to, you know, outside of Pittsburgh and Philly. It's kind of crazy. Likely the House, it's expected that the House will likely flip to Democratic and the Senate to Republican. It's going to be the first time, if that happens, it's the first time ever you're going to see a dual flip that way. All of that's going to have a huge implication to what's going to happen, obviously, later on. And then what will be a huge debate this time is the expiration of the Tax Cuts and the Job Act, out of, you know, the 2017 tax cuts, $3.5 trillion worth of tax cuts are due to go away. And that's the real question. That's going to be probably one of the biggest issues on Capitol Hill this election.
All right. Any other takeaways from the conference?
I would say the only other thing, Amgen came out. I think Amgen was one of the big winners. We did a lot on their pipeline. They were in a lot of panels. You know, this is not just an AMG 133 story this year. I know for investors, it's a winner-take-all situation. But they have seven other data readouts this year, five phase threes, two phase twos. The pipeline here is fairly validated. It's fairly deep. So they really, I would say, on most panels, were sort of the dark horse that was usually overlooked.
All right. Next, I'm going to send it over to your way, Tim, and just kind of reflect on kind of the capital markets and news. I'm looking at the XBI right now. It's right at 99, so just a shade below 100, but it sure was nice, like, mentally. Obviously, it means nothing, but, like, mentally to be back in the triple digits for a little bit. What's your sense of, like, how everything is right now?
Brad, I think Yaron summarized things really well, which is investors are highly engaged. They're focused on biotech. You know, last year it was all about sort of survival, finding those few names that you were going to make money on and kind of avoiding everything else. And so now we're seeing much broader interest in the sector. And I think it's really healthy. It's exciting that, you know, people are showing up at conferences now. You know, at Stifel, we had an investor like dinner, you know, just like invite a few investors over. I mean, so many people showed up and they wouldn't leave, you know, they just wanted to ask questions. So people are really excited by the sector. I think this week will be the first week that's sort of flat to maybe even down a point or two. But if you look back, going back to, you know, right after Thanksgiving last year, you know, the XBI is up a good 30-35%. We try to measure like just R&D stage valuations overall. And if you look at that, those are up now over 50% from the trough last year. And it's a very interesting rally because small caps have done a lot better than large caps. Traditionally, it's the other way around. And I think it's obvious why, right? Small caps are just so far down. I think your own comments on what's happening in the obesity sector and also what's going on politically are incredibly relevant. Obesity has become the dominant narrative in our industry and has really helped to transform our industry. And it's one of the ways in which I think we can sort of make our industry relevant to generalist investors. Yaron also mentioned AI is so important. So just to comment last week on obesity, obviously we saw very exciting news from Viking. Yaron mentioned Novo's news and their capital markets day on their amycretin drug. Novo also reported pretty interesting data on their CB1 receptor inverse agonist in that area. It's exciting. I'm also tracking Sky very closely, which is in that area. Also, interesting company, maybe more interesting than what Novo's got. Yaron, you mentioned Amgen. I think Amgen-133 is really interesting. It could be the drug to beat. It's going to come down to side effects. And Amgen's going to have data, you know, next quarter on AMG-786, which could be interesting. So this is going to be a hopping field this year. And then, you know, the politics, I mean, my goodness, it feels like Trump has a good chance to win the election. I mean, if you'd asked people 2 years ago, is that a realistic possibility? I think most people would say no. And your own comments on it could be a close election, I think, are so interesting. I personally don't have enough knowledge or perspective to know, but it is going to impact our sector in a big way.
My personal two cents on all of this, like, I didn't put out predictions this year, but I do have one big one, and I hope I'm wrong about this, but the thing I worry about is we are so inflamed and polarized at this point. Like, as we get closer to November, there's going to be times when it looks like Trump is going to win. And I worry that a lot of people are going to freak out about that. And there's going to be times when President Biden looks like he's going to win. And I worry that people are going to freak out about that. And I hope I'm wrong, but I worry about, like, things being really, like, truly crazy in the months ahead of that, that could be, like, really disruptive to business and to life. So hopefully that doesn't come about, but it's going to be a wild election for sure.
And I thought what was so interesting about Biden's State of the Union address is that he took a very strident tone. And, you know, he's doing that, obviously, because he knows who he's going to be up against, right? So you can't be a nice guy going up against Trump. And so it is going to be a very divisive election. And your point about what it could mean for the country is well taken.
You know, one thing that came out, maybe just to supplement what Tim said and what you said, Brad, both parties, one of the things they're really, really worrying about is any unexpected, you know, fake AI video. It's the third party informatics and third party governments and their influence in this election could be fairly huge. When you think about the margin.
Yeah. Hey, Yaron, you're kind of cutting off. I don't know if it's your or my end.
Brad, I agree with you. I think that we're going to be, depending which side you're on, you're going to be happy and sad a million times between now and November.
Real quick, the other panelist, Yaron was going in and out. Is that his end or my end?
Yeah, no, it's his
That's
end.
His end.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. All right, let's move on. Luba, I'm actually going to kick it back over to you. Like, you know, dovetailing off of what Tim was talking about, capital markets and just things getting better. You know, the IPO market is looking up too. And one of the, like, more high profile public or private companies that have been in the news over, you know, recent months and year, Boundless filed. Tell us about that.
Yeah, absolutely. And I do, I want to talk a bit about Boundless, which is very exciting on the positive note. And also, I do want to add a few more things on the obesity. I thought they're very great points on the obesity point. So Boundless Bio, it's finally first earlier stage biotech to file IPO for a while. Just as a kind of reminder, it's really the seventh biotech to file for IPO that's in phase one. It's only in phase one since 2023. It does have two programs in phase one, which is pretty impressive. It launched only in 2019 with some great science from Stanford with a Series A of $49 million. So they've done really a fantastic job. They call themselves as the only oncology company in the extrachromosomal DNA space. There are some other technologies that I've seen, but it's great that they're the most advanced. They have developed small molecules to go after cells basically carrying extrachromosomal DNA. We know that cancer cells that use this develop drug resistance. And these oncogenic amplifications are in about 14% of cancer patients and even more in metastatic cancer patients. So what's exciting about this company is not only are they going after this novel approach with small molecules, which is good for IRA, since a lot of people were allergic to small molecules and allergic to oncology. So it's fantastic to see the high appetite for a novel company like this. But what's great also is they did develop a test to find such patients. So I think it's a wonderful package. And it was initially backed by Bayer and Arch. And since that $49 million Series A in 2019, they've raised, they had three private rounds and they raised over $250 million. So it's really great to see it. And especially since most of the companies that we've seen that have filed IPO over the last 18 months have been much later stage in phase two or later. So great news for the industry.
Hey, Luba, I thought it was pretty interesting that their ticker that they chose is BOLD. You know, it was interesting because that ticker, I guess you could say it's a bold move to choose that ticker because that previously belonged to Audentes, which was acquired by Stellus for about $3 billion. And I remember there was a lot of controversy when Ginkgo took the DNA ticker that had previously belonged to Genentech. And a lot of people were giving Ginkgo and Jason Kelly over there a hard time about it. So it got me thinking about these tickers that, you know, they had previous success. Is it good or bad to take on a ticker that was so successful before? Obviously, there's very positive associations for investors, but it could also create some backlash.
That's a great point.
One ticker like that that's had like multiple rounds of success is RxDx. If people remember, Ignita was acquired, and then that was Prometheus's ticker too. And, you know, Merck just acquired them for big bucks. So I guess there's been like good and bad as far as that goes.
There was a research, just very briefly, there was a while ago, this is probably 10, 15 years ago, I remember seeing an economist, a paper from an economist that actually did this evaluation, not in biotech, but just generally, and found some correlation that this is usually a positive if you take a ticker like that. So we'll see.
All right. The next one is something that I'm going to cover that was in the news. So Apogee Therapeutics, this was a company you might remember like a year ago when IPOs were actually shut. It was one of the few companies that did IPO, and they had some data this week, and the stock doubled, and it's now like a $3.5 billion company. And so I'll just quickly go over the background here. And this is the I&I space, which has been, you know, really hot lately. And the idea here is, you know, Dupixent is an amazing drug in indications like atopic dermatitis. That's an IL-4 that kind of hits on both the IL-4, IL-13 cascade. And over recent years, Eli Lilly came out with lebrikizumab, and that's approved in Europe. And I think it's still pending in the US. I actually forget. But they kind of showed that hitting IL-13 is like a better way to do that cascade. And they have really strong data. Dupixent, like the maintenance dosing, is every couple weeks. And lebrikizumab is every month. And the idea behind Apogee is kind of developing a better IL-13. And the data that they announced this week was actually just human volunteer data or a healthy volunteer data. But the whole idea was to see what the half-life of their drug was in humans and what that could potentially mean for dosing. And ultimately what they showed was that the half-life was 75 days. And they think that their maintenance dosing could be somewhere in like the 3 to 6 month range. So if they can have that sort of convenience compared to, you know, potentially monthly from Lilly, that would be a big thing. And some of these inflammatory conditions like atopic dermatitis, a lot of the patients are kids. So to have some, and these are, you know, injectables, and if you can have less frequent dosing, that's obviously a good thing. So it's good to see one of those, you know, high profile IPOs that actually did get through last year, you know, succeeding and making people money, and maybe that, you know, their success will, you know, lead to more IPO success in the future. So that's looking good. Congratulations to them. And I'm going to kick it over. We're going to talk a little bit more about some financings. You know, Brian is, you know, I&I has been really hot, and the TYK2 space has been on fire. You know, so TYK2 is on the market, and, you know, everyone remembers the big deal that Takeda struck with Nimbus that was like $4 billion upfront, and they could still get like a couple more billion dollars in milestones. And there's a company called Alumis that did a financing. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so this was a big private round this week for Alumis. And as you said, they are developing a TYK2 inhibitor. So this is comparable. You know, the lead here is so TYK2 from Bristol-Myers Squibb, which is in launch right now. But obviously, there was a huge deal last year with Takeda acquiring Nimbus's TYK2 for billions of dollars. You know, there's also been some setbacks. A public company, Ventyx, kind of blew up on their own phase 2 study and plaque psoriasis last year. So it's been a very fast moving space here. And Alumis announced that they raised about $259 million. And this is likely based on phase 2 data that they have, or their phase 2 study in plaque psoriasis. The actual data hasn't been presented, but I think it stands to reason, even the CEO kind of alluded to this, that the investors have seen the data and they do like it. So, you know, for that amount of capital raised, one would assume that that it's somewhat impressive. But, you know, I think that's a data set they'll probably present sometime over the next year. And but certainly a very, very substantial round with a great group of investors, and, you know, it's a space that we watch pretty closely. You know, we'll have to see how they differentiate relative to SOTYK2 from Bristol and Nimbus/Takeda's program.
All right. I'm going to go back a little bit to like some of the political stuff, and Daphne, I'm going to go to you. There was an event at the White House this week where a lot of people talked about PBMs, and it sounds like they really were the punching bag. Tell us about that and what it means.
Yeah, so there was a session held at the White House with on the topic of pharmacy benefit managers with the FTC commissioner, Lena Khan, Mark Cuban, and others. And from a biopharma and also a patient perspective, a shift in drug pricing dialogue to focus on the middlemen, I think, is a good thing. The session was designed to find ways to rein in the three largest PBMs, CVS Health, Optum, and Express Scripts, that own nearly 80% of the PBM market. And PBMs are obviously play a crucial role in driving high drug pricing in the U.S., but the biopharma industry has been the one bearing the brunt of negative public opinion and policy. So there are a number of ways that PBMs contribute to high out-of-pocket costs. Much of their business practices are opaque. They favor their own pharmacies over independent drugstores, and they force companies to raise the price for rebates to get favorable formulary placement without passing those rebates on to patients. The three largest PBMs were not invited to attend the session, and they weren't happy about it. They put out a statement saying it would be biased and unproductive because they weren't there. But I think this session, which looks at some of the anti-competitive practices of PBMs, is good for biopharma. And finally, a place where FTC could actually be useful rather than trying mostly unsuccessfully to block M&A. We also know that there are some bipartisan PBM and middleman-focused bills advancing, such as the Lower Cost, More Transparency Act. And Yaron touched briefly on this concept. The Biden administration was putting forward of potentially doubling the size of Medicare's drug price negotiation program to increase the number of drugs that are negotiated each year from 20 to 50 drugs. So I asked a few people about this. So it would require a change in the statute to IRA to increase the number of drugs per year. And from what I hear from policy experts, there's no way this is happening this year, particularly in a divided Congress, but it just doesn't have support. And I was also found it interesting to note that both Pfizer and AstraZeneca have sort of changed their rhetoric around the IRA, with both companies saying that the legislation isn't that negative compared to what they had previously thought. And that makes sense because I think the industry has evolved from fighting the IRA to finding ways to work within it and also to fix some of the more problematic issues through bipartisan legislation, for example, the Orphan Cures Act and the Small Molecule Fix. So overall, I thought these were positive developments.
So I thought the Pfizer headline was interesting. You know, they announced that they had like a big R&D day where they focused on Pfizer wants to be thought of as like an oncology company now. But that was one of the headlines coming out of this. And, you know, I remember when the IRA was, you know, when we were discussing it before it was passed, some people said that if this passed, nobody would ever invest in biotech ever again. And fast forward to like a year later, you have Pfizer saying its impact is like very modest on our industry. And I feel like we've been talking about it, like even on these hangouts every single week for like the last year. I mean, have we made too much of it? Like, is Pfizer right? How do other panelists feel about that?
Brad, I'll make a comment. In addition to President Biden's comments and the White House dialogue and, you know, Pfizer's comments, last week an article was published in Health Affairs. And what that article did is statistically looked at whether or not venture investment declined after the IRA was passed. The answer is it did. But, of course, we were also in a bit of a down cycle. What I think is interesting is we're in an upcycle in the capital markets and venture investment's actually still rather low at the moment. So we're actually in a down year in 2024 for venture investment versus 2023. It's also interesting to look at what's happened to capital formation in a broader sense. So not to be critical of VCs, but they get paid fees for putting money out, right? So if you raise a fund, it's not like you're going to sit on that fund and never invest it. In contrast, limited partners, they in general don't get paid fees for putting money into VCs. And so what's happening with limited partner capital flows, I think, is much more indicative of the impact of the IRA. And if you look at the data, since the IRA was passed, limited partner capital flows have gone in one direction, and it's straight down. So despite all the positive news that we've been discussing in the biotech hangout for, you know, a number of months, the amount of new money flowing into VCs has actually been dropping. And I do think that LPs are aware of the investment dynamics in our industry. And I personally am very skeptical of, you know, comments from pharma companies saying, hey, the IRA is not that bad. Right, because those companies have to have a positive relationship with the government, and that's part of the negotiation process. So I think we have to take, you know, what we've seen this week with a grain of salt.
Anyone else? Okay, Daphne, I'm going to go back to you. You highlighted an interesting comment that Peter Thiel had in the news and that spurred a lot of Twitter discussion. And it was about like entrepreneurship and companies failing. Like a lot of times you hear the saying, like, you know, you learn so much from your failures and like failing is a good thing. And like, as long as you like get the right takeaways from it and, you know, learn to do things a different way the next time. And he was in the news for saying like, that's not true. And I think the basis of his argument was when a company fails, you zero in on one thing that you believe was the reason it failed. But like the reality is there were probably 99 things about that business that like what it would have failed for other reasons. And that failure essentially is overrated. Tell us what you thought about all that.
Yeah, it was interesting because a lot of people were going all in and saying, yeah, we agree. We don't, you don't learn anything from failures. And I think in the case of biotech, it's a little bit different, but some of it applies. So failures can happen because of execution errors, and those could be multiple. You know, there could be many variables, maybe not 99, but, you know, you could, you know, they could be related to financing mistakes, timing, wrong indication, countless other issues, including, for example, poor trial design, you know, just many, many different things that could cause a company to fail. But sometimes in biotech, execution can be perfect, but the hypothesis doesn't pan out in the clinic. And, you know, I guess you could also say, well, you know, maybe that's also an execution error of choice of that program, you know, betting on that hypothesis, et cetera. But, you know, I found the absolutism of the statement to be a little bit unsatisfying because I think you could look as a human being, as an individual, any situation, you could look through the lens of what you as an individual could have done differently or better. So, you know, I do think you can learn personally from what you could have done differently in any situation. I personally also think it's even more important to analyze successes and see whether you can learn and repeat a framework that worked very well. So yeah, to me, I think it's just an interesting discussion. I'm curious what others think. Do you agree with Peter Thiel that failures don't teach you anything?
Well, I think that's kind of a silly thing. I mean, especially for biotech, right? The scientific method is almost by definition an iterative process. So right, your whole goal is to reject the null hypothesis. So you're trying to fail in a scientific experiment, and then changing part of the process and isolating part of the process repeatedly to, you know, kind of arrive a closer truth, right? So I think for biotech it's hard to say that, especially if you could really kind of isolate down you know, points of failure in an experiment. Kind of when you expand more broadly, and there's, you know, tens of thousands of things going on. You know, I get his point, but I think for our sector specifically, I certainly think that it would underappreciate the scientific method to say that you can't learn anything from failure.
I would agree, Brian, with your comments. And I always like to quote the famous 10 commandments from Phil Needleman about R&D. And one of his 10 commandments is fail fast. And in a paradoxical way, a successful pharmaceutical company can be built from failing quickly and accelerating the testing of scientific hypotheses. And so we see biotechs every day that fail and say, hey, we failed. And I think some of the most courageous CEOs are the ones that don't hide it, such as Amylyx this morning, right? I mean, they just got up and said, hey, we ran a study and we failed and we're really sorry for what this means for patients. I think we all sort of look at those guys at Amylyx. We feel for them, we feel for patients, and we also don't feel like they did the wrong thing. They did something very gutsy in starting that company.
Yeah, it's also a matter of personal credibility, right? So, and incentives, like are you incentivized to fail quickly, to kill a program, to move resources to other programs? You know, part of, I think, the problem with the industries is the design of, you know, you have a company and it might have one program and everybody's fate in the company sort of rises and falls on that program. And so there's a disincentive. But definitely those leaders that build credibility are the ones that are willing to fail fast and then move on to other programs or even shut everything down. You know, so I think that's really important.
All right, moving on. I want to go back to Luba. Is she on? I actually don't see her.
Yeah, I think she might have dropped
off. I'm back. Oh, no, back.
There she is.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. Sorry, yep. Did you have a question?
Yeah, I wanted to ask you about a Wall Street Journal article about the obesity space that caught a lot of people's attention. And the idea behind it was like, when are we like, is there with large companies like the Novos and Lilies mm-hmm. of the world, like, you know, already being out front, is there room for improvement in these drugs and for smaller companies to have innovations. And one of the key areas that they highlighted was the fact that in addition to weight, you lose muscle. And there's a lot of companies working on that with like myostatin inhibitors and things. Mm-hmm. Tell us more about that and what your takeaway was from that story.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, by the way, this is fitting with the overall discussion that we're having today, which is, you know, I'm excited that Wall Street Journal has picked this up as a, just a general purpose article. So this is something, even the way that it was written, it was really written for general audience and potentially, hopefully, general investors as well. Just explaining basically to markets and others that there is this growth and need in a very high unmet medical need area, such as obesity, and then explaining what Ozempic does, and to your point, Brad, what it doesn't. So, first of all, as you said, there are side effects, and the major one being muscle wasting. And there are also Ozempic and drugs like that don't work for everyone. That's the second issue. And the third is that there is a possibility, and this is where Lilly and Novo are going to now, is there's a way that we can now finally start looking into large therapeutic areas such as obesity and diabetes, and thinking about it more in a precise way and looking into precision medicine outside of oncology and immunology and rare disease and applying it here in the obesity space. So some of the areas that Lilly and Novo are looking for is, number one, addressing the side effect and seeing how you can, in combination with your drug, have another drug that is for muscle wasting. And we've seen Lilly acquiring Versanis to do exactly that. We've seen companies like Juvena just raised, well, not just in 2022, raise $41 million. Also for Series A, for developing a drug for muscle wasting. And we're looking into not just combination for that, but also in combination with other areas such as diabetes, with comorbidities, heart failure, depression. And so there's quite a lot of need. There are some great companies that are starting up right now. But there certainly is space to really develop a lot more drugs and new modalities. So outside of what we have today. So as an example, right now there is a focus and emphasis on how do we go after metabolism. So that is truly the holy grail. So BioAge is one company that just recently raised $170 million doing exactly that. A company called Rivus is also working on understanding metabolic rates. So if we can go after metabolism specifically and not just satiety, that will make a major change, bring a major change to how we treat obesity and just cardiometabolic disease, period. So we're also looking into other companies, for example, in addition to other side effects, there where patients can't even tolerate the current drugs or they don't respond to current drugs. So there are companies like Orso Bio is another example that is learning from hibernating bears and, again, going after a different type of a mechanism for obesity. So I think this opens up a great space for new companies to come in. And hopefully the LPs will find, as we're just discussing, VCs, yes, they have money, they have interest, they know that they're going to go after now cardiometabolic disease, obesity, more precision medicine and differentiated mechanisms in the space. But hopefully these types of articles and understanding also signals to potential LPs that there is still a lot of innovation that can happen and a big change for patients if they invest in VCs that ultimately build these companies.
Yeah, and of course, just like a week ago, we had the Viking data. And I thought it was interesting, like even though the stock surged and like, you know, they enjoyed all the success from that, there were some like bearish people out there that raised the issue of like, you know, how is something years from now going to compete with, you know, the Lillies and Novos that are going to have been on the market for many years and really like, you know, established like such a huge presence. It'll be interesting to follow. In the interest of time, we'll move on. I'm going to go back to you, Daphne. There was some controversy in the news this week. So David Sinclair, who's like a longevity researcher at Harvard, apparently has like a supplement company, and they're selling supplements that he had some questionable terminology on, like, how proven or unproven this is to extend the lifespan of dogs. And I think this is actually going to be an issue that's going to be in the news a lot, because there's like another company that I've visited in San Francisco called Loyal that's going to be commercializing their products pretty soon. And of course, like, we all love our dogs, and like, anybody would do anything to, you know, have them live longer. It's one of, you know, life's saddest things that canines do have such short lifespans. And the science behind it is actually pretty interesting. It's like, you know, the general rule is the larger the dog, the shorter the lifespan. And that's actually the opposite of like the rest of the animal kingdom. And the scientific rationale is just kind of how dogs have been bred over time. There's some weird things that have caused that to be the case. But what did you make of this? And does it have any follow through also to like the human longevity sector, which is, you know, heating up right now, and you have to be very careful about hype and statements and everything as far as that goes as well, of course.
Yeah. Longevity is just one of those areas that's been, you know, obviously really difficult, but if anybody makes real progress, it could be obviously huge, hugely lucrative and impactful. This news caught my attention because it speaks to some of the broader themes of, you know, credibility, which we were just talking about, reputation, conflicts of interest. It's also got some biotech history because of the people involved. So what happened, as you mentioned, there was a preprint paper published by a company called Animal Bioscience that reported the results of a clinical trial in older dogs with a veterinary supplement that they're developing. And David Sinclair, who's a professor at Harvard and well-known longevity researcher, promoted the study on Twitter, calling it, quote, first of its kind supplement, clinically proven to slow effects of aging in dogs. And he linked to the supplement's product page. So this angered the former dean of Harvard, Jeff Flier, and other longevity scientists who, in addition to pointing out that David Sinclair's brother is the CEO of Animal Bioscience, said that the preprint study only showed a temporary effect on cognition and had no effect or on other aging indicators like activity level and mobility. And you know, so I think this topic might be also interesting to our audience for other reasons. The first is that some of us are old enough to remember Sirtris, which was centered on resveratrol and was also founded by David Sinclair along with Christoph Westphal, and then acquired by GSK for about $720 million. I remember that being a big acquisition at the time. Following that acquisition, Sinclair and other Sirtris employees started selling the lead resveratrol compound, which was still in development at GSK, as a dietary supplement from a nonprofit that they were part of. And then, as those of us who know the history know, GSK ultimately discontinued the program, and research from multiple other groups cast doubt on the anti-aging effects of sirtuins. So that's, you know, just sort of a biotech trivia history kind of thing. But then the second reason it's worth discussing is that, for me, it raises questions of conflicts of interest. So should scientists affiliated with a company be promoting and benefiting from the sale of products? And if not, how is that different from getting shares in a company and benefiting from the sale of stock? So I'm curious to hear what other people think about that.
I mean, Daphne, it's a good topic. And, you know, the aging field is going to be important eventually. And we don't need that kind of stuff, right? I mean, the conflict is pretty egregious. And, you know, people want to live longer, right? So they're kind of open to this stuff. And so it's particularly unhelpful when a scientist makes comments like that.
Yeah, all right. And I agree, it's not just conflict. I know we're almost at time. It's not just conflict of interest, but it just goes back to to science. There are a number of other biotech companies that have, you know, in early stages, including actually in the space of metabolism, that are making a big, potentially could make a big difference in the longevity and healthy aging space. So this is unfortunately a distraction from really great science that people are doing. And not to forget, I know everybody just wants to take a pill and make things easy, but there are also great digital applications as well that that help patients as well maintain healthy lifestyle.
Maybe I'll jump here, Michal Preminger here. I just wanted to, given that I spent a bit of time in the HMS digs with David Sinclair and actually also George Church, I wanted to make a couple comments here. So one, with respect to animal health, I think it's a pretty creative approach if you apply great science to take some cutting edge scientific concepts and apply them to animal health. And George Church has done this with gene therapy for dogs to address genetic defects that are impacting longevity of dogs. And when you think about it, it's like an amazing potentially experiment that can expedite the development of technologies and approaches that could be used in human. And it's a very, very large scale experiment that can happen in an industrial setting and paid for by people who get benefit for their pets. So I think that the general approach is great. Just need to make sure that what is tried is scientifically solid and that it's done in a way that that is responsible. And I, you know, I had the opportunity to work with Harvard PIs who tried different maybe outlets for their technologies. And I think there are ways to make this work responsibly and ethically. So not every... not getting involved in a commercial entity does not always have to be problematic. It can be managed. Again, just making sure that things are done in the correct way.
All right. Thank you, Michal. Well, we're actually a couple minutes past the top of the hour now, so I'm going to close this out. This is really great discussion. Very, very busy week of news and also with the Cowen conference going on. Anybody, and any closing remarks? I'll just leave it open for anyone that would like to jump in.
Brad, thanks for moderating this week. And I also enjoyed the Cowen conference. I thought it was really busy. Cowen, Jefferies, and JP Morgan all have that sort of effect around them where there's a lot of other events happening, and you see people in the hallway, and it just, you know, I think those are the three big conferences in biotech, in my opinion, and this is like the one in Boston, so it's obviously great to have everybody in town.
Yeah, it was great to see you, Daphne. Thanks for coming.
Yeah, thanks, Yohan. It was good to see you too.
All right, with that, we'll close things out. Thanks, everybody.
Thanks, everyone. Thanks, Brad. Have a great weekend. Bye.
Thanks.